This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob.
And it's the Friday Recap, where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week.
Before we get started today, I wanted to share some news with everyone about All In. This talk show has been a great way to connect with folks all across the state, and our small team has enjoyed every minute of it. Unfortunately, All In will air its final show on April 1st, 2022. That's coming up in a couple weeks. It's not an April Fool's joke. It just happens to be the date. We believe in full transparency, so I wanted to let you know that the show was being canceled. It was a decision made by the board of directors at Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and what we've been told is that it was made for financial reasons. It's been a pleasure to serve the community with this program, and with the few weeks we have left, please don't hesitate to reach out if there are topics you'd like us to cover before we're out the door. Thank you so much for being a wonderful audience. And as always, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. In the meantime, since we're still here, it's time to get back to business and talk about the issues. Today, we're joined by public media reporters from around the state to talk about the latest Indiana news and learn about some of the legislation they're keeping up with. We're joined now by Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thanks, as always, for having me on.
You've been following a lot of bills at the State House. Can you tell us what is the latest that's happening with vaccine mandates?
Yeah, so the House Republicans made their top priority this session, was making it harder for private businesses to enforce COVID-19 vaccine mandates. They were responding to anger from some constituents and complaints about being suspended or even without pay or even fired if they refused to get the vaccine, particularly, it should be noted, from healthcare workers. So the House Republicans relatively easily passed a bill that would, as I said, effectively make it impossible for private businesses to enforce COVID-19 vaccine mandates. Because what they did was they said, if you request a medical exemption and have a note from a healthcare provider, the company has to grant the exception, no questions asked. It also said, if you request a religious exemption to getting the COVID-19 vaccine, and there's no paperwork or anything, it literally, you say, this goes against my beliefs, the company has to grant that exception, no questions asked. So a mandate that can't be enforced isn't really a mandate. So the House passed that relatively easily along party lines. Then it got to the Senate, and the process has not been so easy. The Senate really gutted a lot of the bill, quite frankly. Where it sits right now in the Senate is that the Senate just reverted basically the bill to what I would call the status quo, which it says, yes, if you have a note from a healthcare provider that says you shouldn't get this vaccine, we will, you know, companies have to honor that. But as far as the religious exemption goes, it says if you request a religious exemption to getting the vaccine, a company simply has to follow current federal law in deciding whether or not to grant you that exemption. It also allowed companies to expand testing a little bit beyond what the bill originally called for of employees who don't get the vaccine and other minor things. Well, not minor things, but other things like that. But that was the biggest change in the Senate. And now we're going to see whether the House and Senate can come to an ultimate agreement on what the final product should look like over the next couple of weeks.
Another bill you've talked about previously with us is the handgun permit bill. Have there been any updates with that?
just a small one. So the House easily passed legislation that was very simple. It said you no longer have to get a permit to carry a handgun in public in Indiana. This is something that House Republicans have been pushing for years. The Senate has long been reticent to do that. And this year seems to have shifted a little bit. But last week we saw an 8-hour hearing on that bill. In which we mostly heard what we've been hearing all along, which is proponents say it's a constitutional right that should not be infringed in any way, and that only law-abiding citizens will follow that law anyway, so there's no point to having it. Of course, what people on the other side say is, well, we infringe constitutional rights all the time in reasonable or not ways, and there are thousands of people every single year who apply to the state for a permit to carry a handgun in public and are denied by the state police for one reason or another. They've committed a crime, they have a history of mental health issues, things like that. Then Superintendent of State Police Doug Carter got up to speak and raised a lot of eyebrows. The police have always been opposed to this bill. They say that the permit system is the only easy way for an officer in the field, like in a traffic stop, to check whether the person that they've pulled over, the person they're interacting with, has a permit to carry a handgun. So if they have a handgun and they're carrying and they're not on that list, well, that's a problem. Doug Carter went far beyond those criticisms. He criticized Republicans. He said that they were acting not out of the interest of public safety, but in the interest of getting reelected. He criticized the supermajorities for stifling debate. He really went at them in prepared remarks. I mean, these are things he had planned and written down. So that opened a lot of eyes. And then at the end of the committee hearing, the committee suddenly gutted the bill, like out of nowhere. To basically get rid of the change in law entirely. Now, Senate Republicans leadership and House Republican leadership have pledged, we're going to revive this bill in another piece of legislation. We're going to go back to the original, get rid of the license to carry permit system, and that will probably end up being passed by the end of session.
Are there any other states that have similar legislation around carrying a handgun without a permit that they're looking at?
Yeah, there are about 21 states, I think, that's what we've heard, 21 states that have gotten rid of the license to carry. One, for instance, Vermont has never had a requirement to carry, a permit requirement to carry in public. And then there are 29 states, as well as the territories, who still have some sort of requirement like that in place.
There's also a bill that would allow some felony offenders to serve their sentences at the Indiana Department of Corrections. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Sure. Back in 2013, the General Assembly had gone through a roughly 5-year process of completely rebuilding its criminal code. And one of the key tenets of that process was low-level felons, so nonviolent, usually first-time offenders. They wanted to keep them out of the prison system because recidivism rates were higher when you go to DOC. And they were arguing, well, these are low-level nonviolent offenders. A lot of times they have mental health or substance abuse issues. And so if we keep them out of the prison system and put them in the communities, in community corrections programs, in treatment programs, in their local communities, that will help rehabilitate them better and keep them from reoffending. The problem is that over the last almost 10 years now, the state hasn't followed through with getting treatment options in place in some local communities. Some communities have great options set up. Some do not. And so what we're seeing in those communities is that the local jails are just filling up because you can't move these offenders to prison. So where do they end up if there's no local community corrections programs or treatment options available? Well, they just wind up in the county jail. And sheriffs at the local level who run those jails are very candid and say, we don't have the programs and the facilities that these people need. Like, this is not a good option for us, and it's not a good option for them. So what this legislation would do would say judges in individual cases can decide where's the best place to put this offender. Is it in the Department of Correction, which now has, they say anyway, more treatment options available? Or is there a community corrections program? Is there a local treatment option? Well, let's send them there. Is it just the county jail the best place for them to go? Well, let's send them there. But it gives the judges a lot more flexibility to decide what the best place for that offender is.
I want to move on a little bit to some tax stuff. The Indiana House passed a $1 billion tax cut package. What is this aiming to do? And what are the recent updates with this?
What is it aiming to do? Get people reelected? I'm being a little bit glib, but that's a big part of it, quite frankly. The tax cut package aims to, they say, improve our tax climate when it comes to, well, there's two reasons the House Republicans say they've been pushing this bill. One, it's a mix of business utility and individual income tax cuts. And let's separate those out a little bit because they kind of fall into two categories as to why Republicans are pushing them. The utility and individual income taxes are taxes paid by Hoosiers. So obviously the individual income tax, most Hoosiers pay that. And then the utility taxes are taxes that you see on your utility bill. And so House Republicans are saying if we, in the case of income taxes, reduce those and the utility taxes eliminate those, that's money that's going back into Hoosiers' pockets. And right now, Indiana is undoubtedly flush with cash. We have record levels of budget reserves and surpluses. The business taxes is not about giving money back to Hoosiers so much as it is, they say it's a reduction, it's a variety of reductions in the business personal property tax, which is a tax that businesses pay on their equipment, everything from a computer to a combine harvester or a boiler. And what Republicans say and what businesses say is that, well, this is hurting our ability to compete for companies coming to Indiana, which is, you know, they'll, you know, when a business is deciding where to locate, they take a look at a wide variety of options. And this is one tax that they say makes us less competitive. Now, it should be noted that the Tax Foundation recently ranked Indiana as the best tax climate for businesses in the Midwest and one of the 10 best in the country. So how much is this going to help? Well, I don't know. But that's sort of the driving forces behind this tax cut package. Where it is right now is Senate Republicans have been pretty steadfast that they don't like cutting taxes at all this year because they're a little worried about the economic future and they would rather wait until next session, which is a budget writing session, to take a look at the full picture before making any major decisions. But Governor Holcomb, who used to be on the Senate Republican side, has now joined House Republicans in saying, listen, I've looked at the latest numbers. I think we're in a great position financially speaking, and I think we can both make a significant tax cut this year and make all the spending priorities that I think we need next year. So let's do it. I think it's looking like we will probably end up with some sort of tax cut this session. What exactly tax cut that is, I can't say yet.
Thank you so much. That's Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Coming up, we'll revisit some other conversations we had over this last week, including one where we learn about an Indiana bill that would ban transgender girls from participating in girls' sports. A reminder, this show is not live. If you want to reach out to us, you can leave us a voice message at 866-476-3881 or reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Again, the number is 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about LGBTQ laws in Indiana and about a bill that aims to ban transgender girls from girls' sports in school. We're also going to learn about the history of LGBTQ laws in the state. We're continuing our conversation with Kit Malone, advocacy strategist at the ACLU of Indiana, and Zoe O'Halen Byrne, director of marketing and communications at the Indiana Youth Group. Before we continue talking about House Bill 1041, I do want to say that we reached out to the author of the bill, Republican State Representative Michelle Davis, and invited her on the program. She was unable to attend. We're still awaiting a statement from her office. So I guess, you know, we'll wait for that to come in. And in the meantime, Kit, when it comes to House Bill 1041, does this only apply to trans girls or does this impact boys, trans boys in sports as well?
That's one of the things that makes this bill so virulently unconstitutional is that it specifically singles out trans girls, a selected class of people for unequal treatment in their schools.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, I'm just trying to think about this. Like, it's targeting trans girls. It seems like a lot of laws target women and trans women. Is this the continued sort of way our society is operating?
I think if you ask those of us who are trans girls, we would say, yeah. I mean, we see the direct line in our society's disregard for women in the way that transgender women are specifically singled out to be sort of punching bags in these big cultural fights.
Yeah, so, I was going to say, with like when you look at the bathroom, when there's bathroom bills or any kind of argument against trans women using bathrooms, it was always the trans women that were singled out. You rarely heard them say, well, we don't want trans men in the men's room. It was always, we don't want trans women in the women's room.
Yeah, I mean, I'm realizing this now as I'm having this conversation with you both, that I think most of the time I've only heard of it in light of trans women. And Zoe, if trans girls can't participate in girls' sports, are there proposed alternatives? Have the folks who are proposing this bill come up with their own sort of solution to it?
You know, I haven't heard much about any solution. You know, people throw around, sometimes you see it on social media, say, well, trans people can compete, but they should be in a trans league. And I've seen no one really step up to make that happen. Also, there's the whole issue of being otherized, saying, okay, we recognize that you're a woman, but you're not this kind of woman, so you need to go. It's just a weird form of segregation, just worded slightly differently. Also, a lot of these schools, do these schools have enough trans girls to make their own trans girls team? Probably not.
Yeah, and I would like to add that in the injunction filing against Idaho's attempt at passing a law like this, which is currently under injunction and not able to be enforced, the court found that forcing trans girls to, say, participate on a boys team was in effect a ban on participation, because the practicalities of those poor girls being able to participate on that team led to a bar that was so high that most of them would be unable to do so.
With regards to House Bill 1041, Kit, it passed out of the Senate yesterday. Did you anticipate this would happen?
Yes. We fought hard. We brought our best case to the legislature, but they refused to do the right thing by trans people and went ahead and passed it. And unfortunately, this is an election year for a lot of folks over there, so they felt like they needed to get something some red meat out the door, and so it happened.
Zoe, were you surprised at all? Did you think that there was a chance it wouldn't go through?
I wish I could say I was surprised, but as a trans woman who's born and raised in Indiana, I'm sorry to say I expected it to happen, so I'm not surprised.
I think that I am surprised in that this represents a change in Indiana over the last 5 years or so. Over the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen sort of yearly attacks, but the legislature has been slow to take them up, and we've been able to work with them to keep those things from seeing the light of day. But it sort of feels like the passage of this is the start of something new and dark in Indiana.
What would be the next steps for the ACLU now that this bill has passed? I thought I was reading that you have a lawsuit ready to go.
Yeah, we are ready to sue. When this bill becomes law, we will be taking it to court.
And what would that be like? I guess for folks who are tuning in and aren't really familiar with the process, does that mean they'll have to halt it if the governor signed it?
That will be the goal, to obtain, injunction on the state's ability to enforce this unconstitutional law, to have it declared unconstitutional. As far as the mechanics of that, I'm not a member of our legal team, so I don't want to go into too much detail in case I say something that is legally not true. But I do have assurances from our lawyers that we'll be taking this case, and that they have high confidence that we'll win.
Earlier, you mentioned that this goes against civil rights law and other such laws. Can you help us understand that, just for, how this fits into all of that?
Sure. So let's start with, Title IX has been thrown around a lot in the discussion around this. Title IX is the portion of the 1964 civil rights law that really governs students in schools. And Title IX law, says that it is illegal to discriminate against, kids in schools according to sex. There's a list of characteristics: sex, religion, race, etc. The key word here for us in this case is sex. Just a couple of years ago, a conservative Supreme Court found that Title VII, a similar title that governs workplace discrimination, that the word sex in that title covers gender identity-based discrimination. They found that you cannot discriminate against trans people in the workplace, because discriminating against trans people is sex discrimination in a very straightforward way. So it is the opinion of the Department of Justice, the Department of Education, the ACLU as well, the ACLU of Indiana, that extends to all the titles in civil rights code, because it's a very straightforward argument, and that we can expect that we will be victorious in this case because of that.
Zoe, we've talked about this bill at the Indiana State House, and I want to talk a little bit more broadly about it. And I know we kind of touched upon this earlier, but just to help us understand, what is the main argument for banning transgender girls from participating in girls' sports, specifically here in Indiana? What are lawmakers saying?
The argument against trans women and trans girls in girls sports tends to center around the idea that those who were assigned male at birth are somehow predispositioned to be immensely more talented in the world of athletics than those who were assigned female at birth. Like I said earlier, it really comes down to this patriarchal sexist belief that one biological sex is more dominant to the other. But they fail to see the fact that these trans girls are girls. They're not dominating a sport. You know, they're not out to take it away from girls because they're girls too. But it seems to be the stumbling block for the people who oppose trans rights is that they can't differentiate sex from gender.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that news stories that cover like professional swimmers at the college level, I think there's one swimmer in particular, Leah, I can't remember her last name. Do you think those help or hurt the community?
It really depends on who's looking at it and how it's being framed. Every media outlet is going to handle the story differently. Some are going to frame it as she's an amazing athlete and people are now discriminating against her, whereas other people are going to frame it as, look at this trans person who's making it so hard for cis women to be athletes. So it really fluctuates between who you ask and who you're getting the news from, whether it's hurting or helping the community. But in many ways, it's helping because it is shedding light on the fact that, you know, we trans women are out there. We live lives and we should have the same right to success as anyone else.
And I think that it's difficult to watch the media coverage around any successful trans woman sometimes as a trans person, because you do feel like they're going to be divided into those camps. And instead of just being able to celebrate that one of your sisses is out there, you know, kicking butt, you have to sort of grit your teeth and worry about who's going to come for you now. Because someone was, you know, had the temerity to succeed. Also want to point out that like one passive way that media can make this difficult is by always framing our successes as controversies. When there is, you know, not even like in an attack article, but simply saying, for instance, you know, Leah breaks records, controversy erupts. You know, there's always sort of an asterisk by our successes.
Yeah, and I think part of that is tied to the idea that everything gets boiled down to one term that people love to throw around is biologically male, which is such a weird way to phrase it, because people get this idea that there's a solid 100% inflexible binary to people's biology. And when you ask them to define biologically male, they can't do it in a way that's supported by science. They miss the fact that, you know, biological makeup is a spectrum. There are intersex individuals who are transgender. There are there's just such a wide spectrum. When you ask them to define what they consider biologically male, it's usually something that on a technical science level won't actually hold up all that well.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder sometimes too, for folks that you mentioned that maybe intersex, just watching this all go down around them, and it's like there's nothing that they can do about that.
Yeah, it's a shame, you know, that there's not more education out there. There's not more understanding. There's not even a will to understand. People like to go on the defensive and attack anything they don't understand. And there comes a point where it's not a lack of understanding, it's a lack of compassion.
What do you think it is that drives the fear of wanting to educate themselves or learn more in this particular area?
I think there's a lot that goes into it. I think there are so many people who have such a stubborn, heels dug in view of what the world is. Everybody wants to see everything in a shade of black and white. They miss the grays. They don't want to be told they're wrong. They don't even want to consider the fact that they are, because if one piece of their world puzzle is challenged, they're going to have to start reconsidering how the whole puzzle fits together.
And I think there is a numbers issue here. when we look at, so the trans movement in terms of trans equity has always lagged behind the broader LGB movement, lesbian, gay, bisexual, et cetera. Trans people have always sort of been the sort of like trailing edge of that. And one of the reasons is simple numerics. Trans people represent a fairly small proportion of the population compared to LGB people. And we know that familiarity breeds tolerance. We know that like having a friend or a family member or a cousin or an uncle or a brother or a sister who is LGB, you know, breeds acceptance. And trans people, so many people, when you speak to, have had, never had a meaningful relationship with a trans person. And we know that acceptance of trans people is highly correlated with having a meaningful relationship with us. So even going beyond just the questions of like educating ourselves, we don't even really benefit from the passive acceptance of familiarity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'll be honest, when we were doing this show and planning it out, I was a little bit nervous because I'm not super familiar with all the proper terminology and how to approach this. And I was like, I want to make sure that we do this in the best way possible, because I think it's important that we learn and understand and connect with one another. And something that I was wondering too, Zoe, when it comes to schools in Indiana, have you heard of them being in support or opposition to House Bill 1041?
Most of the schools that I've heard from are opposed. A lot of these schools even showed up to the State House, you know, the State Teachers Association, the school board folks were showing up to say, this is ludicrous. We don't want to have to discriminate against our students. We are very lucky that a lot of schools across the state are thinking very proactively in favor of our trans youth. We here at IYG, we manage the Indiana GSA, that was formerly the Gay Straight Alliance. It's now the Genders and Sexualities Alliance. We administer the state organization, and we are finding more and more schools are reaching out, asking us how they can be there, how they can make their schools a more accepting and better place for trans students. So we have a lot of hope here that these schools are out here to protect the youth and do what's best for them, and that they oppose these discriminatory measures.
Kit, in terms of the legality for this House Bill 1041, is it legal in Indiana to pass bills like this, which seem to target groups of people, allegedly?
Oh, that's a complicated question. I mean, it's legal to pass the bill. Whether or not the bill passes constitutional muster at the end of the day is up for the courts to decide.
So I guess it's just keep passing bills and see which ones go through at this point.
Yeah, I mean, that does often appear to be the philosophy down at the General Assembly. We have a long history of suing on laws that have been passed by that body and winning. So I definitely, as a lawmaker said on the Senate floor debate on 1041 yesterday, you know, I put my money on the ACLU.
Would you say that LGBTQ folks are protected by anti-discrimination laws in all states, including here in Indiana, or is that still work that needs to be done?
That's another complicated question. But what I would say is that we are protected by federal law from discrimination. That's been pretty clearly established by the Supreme Court. As of today, that you cannot discriminate against LGBTQ people. Now, the fact that Indiana is one of a number of states that has failed really to specifically protect LGBTQ people, you know, leads to a lot of confusion in the state about when and where you are protected. It's something that I would love to see lawmakers take up, but I have doubts in this atmosphere that that's something they'd be willing to do. You know, we still have a situation where we need something like the Equality Act instead of simple, you know, the court precedent that is very clear. But we need really like law. And we really need to settle this for all LGBTQ Americans across the country, so that we don't feel like our rights are different when we move from one city or from one state to another.
And we just heard from Kit Malone, advocacy strategist at the ACLU of Indiana, and Zoe O'Halen-Byrne, director of marketing and communications at the Indiana Youth Group.
Up next, we continue the Friday recap and we'll check out a podcast called Trade-Offs, now in its third season. We'll hear from the folks behind that. Stick around. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. It's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. A reminder, this show is not live. For our final segment, we'll talk to some of the people behind Trade-Offs, a podcast about complexities and unintended consequences within the healthcare industry. We're joined by founder and executive editor Dan Gorenstein and reporter-producer Ryan Levy. Dan, we were just talking about harm reduction around drug use, and I want to also talk about some of the other stories that you've done. You've made a special series on a new mental health crisis line. What is this line that we're talking about here?
Sure. The new line is 988, and it in October 2020, Congress, I mean, this was right before the presidential election, COVID stuff was swirling. Like, I certainly didn't hear about it. I don't know if many people did, but Congress created 988. It's a new three-digit number that anyone in the U.S. or the territories can call for help in a mental health crises. They pass this, and basically the law converts the existing National Suicide Prevention Lifeline from what is currently 10 digits down to just these 3988. But this is not a new suicide lifeline. This is, Congress wanted this number to be a lot more than that. And, you know, we say it like this in the story, they saw it as a front door for people in all kinds of mental health crises.
And Ryan, what do you think prompted the creation of this line? I mean, it sounds like, Dan, you're saying it's basically sort of transferring you to the line of the original hotline with some other added things.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I would defer to Dan a little bit on some of the kind of the background. But I think, you know, mental health is an issue that has become more and more a focus of regular folks as well as policymakers. We're seeing, you know, even before the pandemic, mental health was a growing crisis that we were hearing. Certainly, you know, in our reporting, we were hearing a lot about in terms of, you know, not having enough mental health clinicians and treatment opportunities for folks. And the pandemic has made all of those problems even worse with just all the, you know, when we've all just been living through such a challenging time. And so I think there's a recognition that, you know, folks need to be able to access mental health services more easily. And I think this number, you know, a simple, easy three-digit number that could connect you to, you know, whatever kind of, ideally could connect you to whatever kind of service or help you need, was seen as something that could really help in this moment.
Right. On that point, you know, more than 130,000 people, you know, we were talking about harm reduction before the break, 130, you could look at sort of the creation of 988 as another example of potentially of harm reduction, like 130,000 people combined died from suicide or overdose. And I think like in 2020, no, I've got that data point wrong. Sorry about that. But you have, not only do you have all these people dying from suicide or overdose, you also have, according to the Washington Post, police have fatally shot more than 1,500 people with mental illness in just the last 6 years. And so there's a real crisis. And I think there's some optimism, there's some hope, Miriam, that 988 is going to, in fact, really spur more people to get help in 2020. The Suicide Prevention and Lifeline got 3 million calls, texts, and chats. And some federal officials estimate that that could quadruple to 12 million in just the first year. I don't know that it will, but like, we're talking millions more people potentially getting access to services here. It's on its face, theoretically, this is a game changer. And I use that understanding that it's a cliche and a bit of an eye roll, but I think it actually is, it's got some of that possibility.
Ryan, how common is it for people experiencing a mental health crisis to call 911 instead of another hotline?
Dan may have more on kind of some of the specifics there. I mean, I do know that, you know, Dan had that number about, you know, the number of folks who've been shot by fatally shot by police with the mental illness. You know, that's one in four of people fatally shot by police overall had a mental illness. And we see, you know, 44% of people in jail report a history of mental illness. So clearly the, you know, we are seeing mental illness get subsumed and often kind of offloaded into our criminal justice system. And I think that's one of the issues that in theory 988 is really designed to prevent. And this idea that, you know, police and law enforcement are not the ones who are best trained or equipped to help people in the middle of a mental health crisis. And so if we can provide, you know, another number that folks can call that can connect them to more suitable services, we can help a lot more people and avoid some of the really tragic consequences we see when folks suffering from mental illness are met by law enforcement.
You know, a really important point here is that for people of color, getting law enforcement involved can be a very dangerous thing. Black people currently today are more than twice as likely to be fatally shot by police compared to white people. And when you add mental illness into that, a black person's risk of being killed by police quadruples. And so in the big questions, Miriam, are, okay, so you've got this line, 988 goes live in July, I think it's July 16th, and in some places, actually, 988 is live right now, but in many places, it is not. And so there are three sort of big questions that need to be answered. Who's going to be answering these calls? Where will callers in crisis go if they need to go somewhere that's not just a phone call? And how's all of this work going to actually be funded? And what we're trying to do with our 988 coverage is begin to explore some of these foundational questions. If you talk to people who are excited about 988, they're going to say to you that potentially you're going to have a lot more people who are able to access calls. And to be clear, you know, however many million calls come in, or calls, text, chats, whatever come in, 80% are expected to be dealt with, resolved through a phone call, and 20% are going to need some sort of more. But we need to sort of, because so much of this is happening so fast, there are lots of important questions like, what sort of training are the people who are going to answer the calls get? What evidence is that training based on? How well staffed are these call centers to handle this influx? Like, a lot of the calls right now for suicide are taken by volunteers. This is not the role for a volunteer. How well will these jobs be paid? Will there be the money to do this? It is really, it's daunting to think about how many questions have to be answered, and it really epitomizes just how much of a start this is as a starting point.
Right, right. Well, Dan, can you tell us about Andrea, who was featured in your show?
Sure. So Andrea, I won't say too much about Andrea, at least to start, but back in 2012, Andrea was really struggling. She's one of millions of Americans who was not getting any treatment at all. Untreated childhood trauma had led her to experiment with pills, and then she started using crack, and then she ultimately used heroin. And we can play some tape that talks about that one particular day for her here. Andrea's crisis began in an alley in Huntington, West Virginia.
I wake up and I'm terrified.
She'd just been revived by paramedics after overdosing on heroin. All her usual thoughts tumbled through her mind that June morning in 2012. Am I going to be arrested? How am I going to get my next fix? And a new idea.
I could choose to not be here.
Her sons were 10 and 12. Andrea had vowed to never take her life. That's how her mom, Dinah, had died.
Andrea had never forgiven her for that, but today the idea of suicide seemed to fit.
And that scared me. It scared me to death.
Andrea's life had ended up a lot like Dinah's in nearly every other way. Poverty, addiction, homelessness, drifting in and out of her kids' lives. Andrea wandered around all day, haunted by thoughts of her mom and scared of what she might do to herself. In the evening, she camped out in an abandoned house.
It's cold, it's middle of the night, and it's pitch black, and I'm alone.
Shaking from withdrawal, Andrea made a decision. She would kill herself.
My kids would not have to suffer and be embarrassed and ashamed and neglected and abandoned by the person that they should be able to depend on the most. And it was that moment of clarity. As soon as that thought crossed my mind, it just clicked. Oh, Mom. Poor thing. Now I understand how you made the decision that you made. Bless your heart. The anger and the resentment disappeared in that moment. And I could only feel so sad that that was her only way out.
And Dan, how did Andrea get through this?
Andrea had, she had an insight, Miriam. She had lived with the hurt and the pain of her mom having taken, having committed suicide. And she understood, as we put it in the script, the long tale of suicide, the guilt, the hurt, the unanswerable questions. And I think that night in that house, she thought about her two boys. And she didn't want her two boys to go through what she had gone through. And so she decided not to do it. And we can play the next clip here. Andrea changed her mind, but she knew she needed help fast. She considered calling 911, but worried she'd end up in jail. She thought of only one other option.
525-7851.
A place in town where she could detox for a few days. It was the help she could find, not the help she needed. She did detox for 48 hours, but stayed addicted to heroin for 5 more years. Andrea got sober in 2017. She was 41, the same age as Dinah was when she died by suicide. Andrea is 46 now and deeply involved in the local recovery community. She remembers everyone in the crowd she ran with had memorized that same number for the local detox center.
Nobody in the history of addiction has ever been shooting heroin in their jugular and thinking, this is great. You know, you got 8 people in a living room of somebody's house sharing a needle, doing a little tiny bit of stuff so you're not sick. We're all miserable. And the conversation is always, always, how are we going to get away from this? How are we going to get better? How am I going to get the help that I need?
Providing people the help that they need in the moments they need it most is the highest hope for this new 988 number. But as is so often the case with healthcare programs and policies, the difference between high hopes and disappointment will be in the details.
And I do want to mention for our listeners, if anyone is dealing with any of these issues, we do have the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. It is 800-273-8255. Again, it's 800-273-8255. Dan, it's a very heavy story. What did you learn from this, and how did you deal with this topic?
Well, you know, I think Leslie Walker, our senior producer, and I, who worked on this episode, thought long and hard about how to frame Andrea's story, and we're so appreciative and thankful that she was so willing to share this experience with us. And we framed it like this. We thought that her story illustrated two things about person in a mental health emergency, which we thought would be valuable to try to help people understand why 988 and get 988 functioning well matters. And one is that these crises can strike without warning so quickly. And the second point is like they're tenuous and potent. You know, it's like this rare chance to help someone get something that they need, or it could become a missed opportunity and the consequences couldn't be any higher. And so we really wanted to illustrate that and drive that point home. And I think we did. And I just want to share, you know, Andrea got in touch with us with Trade-Offs after this story ran. She's in touch with, she and her sons are very close today. Something that was not included in the story was that the boy's father, Andrea's husband, several years after 2012, did commit suicide. And Andrea wrote to us and she said she listened to the story for the first time with her and her sons in their car. And she said, "I never thought by sharing my mother's story, I'd be able to help my sons cope with their own father's suicide." And, you know, I've been a journalist for 20 years, and it's one of the most rewarding things I've ever gotten to hear back in my life. You try to do the best you can by putting good information out. And if you can do something that helps people heal a little bit, helps give people a little bit more perspective on what matters, then I think you're doing a good job.
And we appreciate all that you're doing. I mean, I think this is a great program just to shed light on the many various things that are happening. And Brian, as we get ready to wrap up here, what is next for the show? I mean, what's the next topic coming up?
Sure. So we're going to be doing more on 988 in the coming months. So definitely, you know, this is a big topic that we'll be touching on more, but kind of the stories that are coming up most next on the list. This week, we're going to be talking about something called Cascades of Care, which is, you know, you go to the doctor and you get a test. And usually we all assume like, oh, you know, the doctor says we need a test, you know, must be a good idea. What could it hurt? But kind of this, the research that we talk about in the story and the stories that we share shed light that there are actually some times where that initial test is not likely to be that useful and can actually lead to a whole bunch more tests and procedures that can cause harm, physical, financial, psychological harm. And we're also going to be doing some stories coming up on Medicaid and some changes coming to Medicaid under the Biden administration.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time today. Ryan Levy, reporter and producer for the show Trade-Offs, and Dan Gorenstein, founder and executive editor of the Trade-Offs podcast. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.